welcome back to the show. Once again, got Kevin Matthews on here, movie blogger himself. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Hope you're well.
You know, I am not dead yet. I am not too occupied. So, tonight's the night. You know, we're doing a double dose of filmmakers that we're talking about, and we just figured, hey, let's talk about one filmmaker who has revolutionized more modern film with discussion on civil rights, uneasy politics, mixed in ranting with satire, and just even more, just atypical material. And so, once again, we're talking Spike Lee, you know, screenwriter, director, producer, occasional actor. Worked on several movies involving the likes of Denzel Washington, John Turturro, Delroy Lindo, Wesley Snipes, Alfre Woodard, and much, much more. So, how did you get introduced to Mr. Lee?
Well, I got introduced to Spike Lee quite late. He was one of those people that I'd always heard of. And I'm going to give myself credit and say years ago I watched Malcolm X. I think that was my first full Spike Lee joint that I watched. But after that, for a long time, it's a bit embarrassing that the main ones I'd seen actually were Inside Man, 25th Hour, and probably Summer of Sam, which collectively probably make up his whitest trilogy of movies. and for Spike Lee films, now that I've got to know more of his filmography, I would say they're not mainly in line with his better films that have his signature more clearly on them. Like, I'm not saying they're bad films, they're great films. But I think for the top tier Spike Lee films that his fingerprints are all over, you know, I think I was happier when I started to discover more and more of his work and really dived in.
Absolutely. So, yeah, again, I had cable back in the day and, you know, movie channels and everything throughout high school and college. And he's just one of those, was fortunate enough to see a lot of just people just growing up, just see a lot of their greatest hits, you know, Jim Jarmusch, you know, even people who I'm not as crazy about, but everyone just adores, like the Coen brothers and, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson. But I was also just keeping up with, you know, other works by Scorsese, Spielberg, and other indie guys like Kevin Smith. And Spike is interesting in that he and Oliver Stone kind of pioneered the whole they had several movies which were often cited as their respective actors' best work to date, you know, award-winning performances. And they could keep making movies without, you know, even much like Tarantino, without just being feared of, you know, career suicide. They could have a movie that, you know, people might not like, and that's okay. They would still be able to keep making them, and, you know, it's interesting how they kept evolving, you know, like they kind of get their emotional words out kind of in the 80s, and then by the 90s they're doing like all different kinds of movies that they're having to, you know, take out some of their own earnings just to get made. Like you mentioned Malcolm X, that's a perfect example of just like movie that almost did not get made and someone had to tell it, so who better than, you know, Spike to helm it. And I've been fortunate enough to even, like you say, just re-see some of his movies, and sometimes if you don't get it right away, you know, just see it again. You have missed something. And I had followed, you know, some of his documentary work as well, and there's one from like 97, I think. What was it? Yeah, Four Little Girls, which was a true crime, you know, documentary. And then you know, the recent New York City epic centers of 9/11 to 2021 and a half. It's just like he's always just doing, you know, just again, atypical kind of material, and then following it up with, you know, music videos, video games, spots. And I mean, people kept even talking about those Super Bowl ads he was in where he was guest appearing in. So he was another one of those people recognize what he looked like. I will even admit that I did a project for junior high talking about him. Mainly just because I, you know, had people who had seen, you know, Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X. And then I was also one of those where, you know, I knew just about everything about a certain filmmaker even before, you know, I had seen their work. And it kept continuing. Like, again, a lot of his movies were not hard to modify for TV, especially Right Thing and Girl Six. And I just took to really enjoying just a lot of his earlier work, like He Got Game, Crooklyn, and, you know, Mo Better Blues. And by the time I got to, again, just some other ones like Clockers and, you know, She's Got a Habit. It was one of those, like, yeah, you like or hate those movies. But I think one that really stayed with me was Get on the Bus. You know, just be talking about just post-50s, you know, laws that still, you know, parallel today's, you know, political climate, and just show how, again, just these group of friends who are just all going to one giant, you know, protest in Washington. Such a giant cast. And, you know, it's even reflecting on the Million Man March. And like you said earlier with, you know, Malcolm X, that was interesting in that he had to show a different kind of, you know, 3-hour biopic, you know. And he and Malcolm are pretty much one and the same coin in that they're angry about so many things, and yet they're able to make it to where you can listen to that anger and understand how these divided issues are still, you know, engulfing us and ruining our lives. And, you know, especially Black America, where, again, progress just never seems to get made, and getting all these just unrecognizable but brilliant performances from these cast members to, you know, and make it all work, you know, you got to applaud them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's, I still haven't seen as much of his filmography as I want to. There are a couple of big titles that I've missed that you've mentioned, actually. She's Got to Have It and Get on the Bus. But
I even did a TV show of it years later, and I was like, that makes sense. It's still, we're seeing a lot of, again, just sexual politics in Black demographics.
But the more I see of Spike Lee's filmography, the more I realize two things, and that is that A, no matter what you think of the film itself, he always has a point that he will hone in on. It's sometimes as subtle as a sledgehammer to the head, but it is sometimes something that he just puts this little underline at the very end, and you're like, right, that was all about this. That's one thing. But also, I think people forget that he will include you know, moments that are also, you know, pure kind of cinematic pleasure as well. Particularly, you mentioned He Got Game. There's a beautiful moment at the end of He Got Game. Doesn't really fit with the film, but it's a lovely bit of cinema. And he kind of does that. I think sometimes he does that to sugarcoat the pill. And, right. You know,
he's the one, he will yell something outrageous, and he knows the right people know what he's about. And he's like, see, you just fell for my trap. Why are you getting all angry?
Yeah.
You know that I don't mean what I mean. But,
and I think it's right that he is the person that can do those films. As you say about Malcolm X, you know, I'm sure we'll probably agree on Black Klansman, which was amazing. But a film that's difficult to discuss and difficult for people to watch, I guess, is 2000's Bamboozled, which is basically
yes.
a scathing indictment of blackface and people who kind of go along with it complicitly because other people don't object as much.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that, but yet you're watching a film that has quite a bit of blackface in it. But Spike Lee knows what he's saying and makes very firm points. And if you don't know what he's saying by the end of that film, then, as you say, you need to rewatch because he's not making any mistakes in his delivery.
Right. Well, and a lot of his documentaries have been shown on TV, including Passing Strange, which is talking about Broadway scene. And you can understand, like you say, on why he finds certain things that, you know, gathers his attentions and he can share his two cents on it. And when I saw the movie Sucker Free City, that was interesting because it's like that was essentially just, you know, a pair's three different types of street gangs together while having them basically much like you know his earlier work on, you know, School Days, where this is basically School Days 2.0, where he's now basically just if a bunch of losers, you know, totally different races all hung out together, you know.
Mm.
Stars of Then Unknown, Anthony Mackie, Ken Leong, and a bunch of other guys. And I mean, I think a lot of his other movies, like you say, have been become even more and more appreciated as time has gone on. Like, Clockers is just so morbid, but I think it's become even more appreciated now that we're in a society where people can watch something like The Wire, they're prepared to watch something very gritty, but reflects some kind of reality of poverty-stricken areas and drug-infused gangs. And, you know, Crooklyn was cool in that it was basically just kind of a more lightweight dramedy, and you know, obviously Jungle Fever was kind of, you know, who else was going to bring up a big giant biracial, you know, argument?
Yeah,
how does a couple marry if they're going to be continually, you know, bamboozled and critiqued, you know, for doing what they wish to do? And his cinematographer who worked with him for the longest time, Ernest R. Dickerson, has gone on to have a giant career. And again, you know, all these actors, you know, are now second nature. You've seen them on everything from, you know, Law and Order to just, you know, Sopranos and Inside Man, I can honestly say, like you say, is it was marketed to the, you know, those who wanted a twisted, you know, cat and mouse, cops and robbers movie, but it brings in so many other things like inept police who don't listen to all the signs in front of their face. You know, you have a bunch of, again, an embarrassing moment where, you know, cops basically pelt the hostages who they believe to be the robbers with just various, you know, gas grenades and everything. It's just like, it's just easily avoidable situation. And he's able to talk about stuff like that that would seem heavy handed to anyone else. And he's able to kind of do it and say, hey, I don't care if you don't want to hear it, I'm going to put it in there, you know. And Miracle at Santa Ana kind of gets a lot of hate nowadays, but I think it's an interesting, atypical take on, you know, black soldiers who served during World War II. But, you know, obviously, Old Boy isn't for everyone. I think really the only source spot for a movie that I have tried to start different times and have struggled to get through has definitely been Summer of Sam. I know what it's all trying right. to say. It's just one of those, I'm just like, it just, there's apparently like a 4-hour cut of it out there, and I'm just like, it's one of those, I find it very unappealing, but I understand why he did it.
It's been a long while since I watched it, but I remember it being, you know, for me, although it has all the characters and quite a lively script, it's also quite an interesting mood piece, really just capturing that atmosphere, you know, from then, from what was going on then with, mm-hmm. with people who, you know, could have extra paranoia heaped upon them.
Right. And apparently almost got an NC-17 rating. Like, it just barely.
But he's worked well with Denzel and others. But I don't know about you. I will pretty much sign up for any movie that has Delroy Lindo in it.
Oh, yeah. What did you think of the Five Bloods?
Yeah, I thought it was great. It was a really fun sort of reworking of Treasure of Sierra Madre. Does that well. That was great. And Crooklyn, as you mentioned, it is a lighter family dramedy, but it's just so well done, and it gives this kind of feels like a star role for Lindo, who is so often, you know, popping up in supporting roles.
Yeah, so I've always been a fan. He's always been that guy kind of actor, and obviously Brooklyn was one of his earlier ones, but he has the guy who says, you know, shit a lot in 25th Hour, so that was cool to see him become part of the cast. But yeah, it is kind of a fun mock on both, you know, Vietnam type movies as well as a modern day, what would a modern day Treasure of the Sierra Madre want, you know, story look like, and just all these, you know, again, ex-cons and ex-soldiers trying to both find a treasure that, you know, someone found. And it's interesting because he does make beggar use of what he'll often do is just show kind of a slow motion kind of fade out. And here, you know, he has just a over the top, almost, you know, dark comedy level, just helicopter crash, just showing how absurd this whole scenario is, you know, and that it's happening right in front of your heads. Kind of like how, like you say, with, you know, Malcolm X, he pretty much just sneaks in more material on just relationships, how every other black person is being accused of rape, you know, in various states. And, you know, He Got Game was kind of his take on making fun of the whole football players, you know, becoming ballers, you know. And here, like you say, he's kind of going back to Inside Man, just showing how, you know, he knows anyone who's smarter than the average bear understands how the whole financial, you know, tycoon storyline works. And here is so wild how they're working with all kinds of guys who don't respect black people and who don't, you know, are in this just to, you know, lead them to the treasure. And I thought it was funny seeing Jean Reno in there as a French businessman with a, you know, Donald Trump, you know, MAGA hat. That was a funny, you know, icing on the cake in terms of just showing how, again, they're working with just despicable people. And after a while, they're still pretty loyal to each other because, again, you know, the brothers, you know, they're brothers in arms. And some of them are willing to even, you know, maybe kill one another if they get in each other's way, because at the end of the day, it's like, we need this money. And you forget after a while that it is basically a heist movie because he's just... And again, like you say, he coats everything in with even more very key themes that no one wants to talk about, you know, and only he can talk about it because he seems to, again, just even if he doesn't think it out, he can make it all just resonate. And you're like, hey, only Spike would bring up something like this, you know, well, like only Tarantino would show cursing criminals and just outrageous violence that is very darkly humorous, and it's second nature to who he is as a person, as a filmmaker, you know.
I think the interesting thing about both The Five Bloods and Inside Man particularly is they showcase how Lee can, he delivers on a surface level, like say The Five Bloods is pretty much a heist movie, as is Inside Man, but they're two sides of a coin. In one way, one is kind of about, you know, there is a point about, you know, well, both in a way are kind of about reparations. One is a comment on the soldiers, many soldiers that were just abandoned when the war was claimed to have been done, and that was it. Inside Man, you know, a direct comment on, well, how did these rich people get so rich? You know, what would the victims ever be due? Is that, you know, is that basically blood money, you know, and can it be distributed better? And they're very different films, and they have, again, they have a core idea that Lee is honing in on, even while he's just delivering you two great movies that are quite different from one another.
1,000%. You could literally probably come up with like maybe five different comedies or heist films, like five different trilogies from his giant, you know, filmography, because he has so many different kinds of themes, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see the clip of him at the Oscars being asked about when Green Book won?
Oh yeah, that was hysterical. He's just like so put predictable.
The English accent on, not my cup of tea.
Yeah. Oh man, and you know, even the comedy specials he's produced and directed, like John Leguizamo's Freak and the original Kings of Comedy, you know, Cedric and Steve Harvey, you know, is like, it makes sense why he did those, because those movies, you know, those comedy specials were basically, you know, they're very racial and they're very, you know, in your face, you know, and who better than him to just say, you know, I'll step in and I'll let you frame your conversations, because we all have similar thoughts, we all have similar takes, you know. It's perfect.
It's I don't want to get really spoilery, but I also thought even his ending of Black Klansman was just so powerful and effective.
I was paralyzed for the rest of the time, like just coming out of that theater. It's like you didn't expect that. It's like, okay, you figured it was a typical making fun of how, you know, these detectives have to go undercover and, you know, take out some key individuals in the, again, the Ku Klux Klan at its most prominent, and making fun of 70s detective movies. There's a few nods as well as parodies, spoofing. Is like, no, this is how we're going undercover, and you're gonna have to face all this ugly racial slurs and pretend to, especially when they're telling the white cop, you're gonna have to pretend like you agree with this, you know. And then there were others who gave that movie some shit because they're like, that's not how it ended. I'm like, it might as well have. That's basically what Spike is going for there. It's like, yeah, there wasn't that car explosion, all this other stuff, but that's fine. That's kind of...
But a lot of it was so funny, like gut-bustingly funny. And then with that ending, like, I don't know if everyone read it the same, but I'm sitting in a cinema and it's almost like, you know, Spike Lee has just leaned forward and said, yeah, they're funny, keep laughing. And if you keep laughing, they'll keep acting, and eventually people die. It's like, right. This is why you can't always just laugh them off.
1,000%.
It was, and again, it was, I know people commented on the use of real footage, and some people disagree with what he does with tone in that film. I think a lot of the time he is just hitting a bullseye with every target he's going for. He's a very, very talented guy that hasn't probably got enough credit for years, when he was, I think people would say he was kind of riffing on the same thing. And I'm like, well, the same problems are all there. And he's equally angry about them because nothing's changing.
Totally. And it took us even kind of a while to just kind of even watch movies like She Hate Me, which is making fun of just so many different things, you know.
Mm.
You know, women taking advantage of more privileged men, trying to get pregnant. And it's just, it's a funny, also just kind of take on how, you know, it's not an easy to market movie. And he dared to just kind of show how, you know, just people will extort and do all kinds of things, and just for something simple, like help gay people get pregnant, you know. And but it's not any surprise that It and Bamboozled, you know, didn't do as hot, because it's just, I think even some of the critics who did like it just said it's like, it's a hot button topics, and you know, how do you, we were getting to that political divided, you know, 2000s, where it was hard to even talk about any of this.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. It is interesting to see how he's evolved and continually just blows your mind. You're like, of course he did that. You know, but I'm still surprised because I didn't expect him to be able to tackle something like that.
I think the biggest blind spot for me in recent years has been is it Charak from 2015, and I was very interested to then see what he would do with that kind of film. So I'm looking forward to catching it at some point. But you know how it is. There are just not enough hours in the day, and the list of movies to watch goes on and on and on.
Right. And I'm sure some of them do merit a rewatch. I'll probably rewatch Girl 6, and I'll definitely re-see Jungle Fever again, which I already like. But it's, you know, Mo Better Blues was one that I was glad that I re-saw because, you know, it's not easy to take it all in just one scoop. It is a, you know, hard-hitting, if you will, take on, you know, much like Clockers. It's like you've got to put away time for it before you watch it. And, you know, some people are going to, again, still find it very angry or hard to get into. And it's just one of those like, well, just sit back, just listen. You know, you got to listen to it.
Yeah, and he's been doing that since, I can't remember if Do the Right Thing was his, was it his first feature or the first one that made an impact for him?
Definitely made a jump.
I think it was definitely one of his first, if he'd done a little bit of documentary work before then or some smaller stuff, but quite a showcase and showed like what he can do when he has an audience that he wants to grab hold of them for a minute or two, just have them sit there while people are throwing slurs at one another.
Right.
And doubling down on sort of the strength and the anger. I know most people will have seen Do the Right Thing if they're checking out Spike Lee, but if people have somehow missed that on their journey, like, it's an essential part of his filmography.
1000%. It's one that gets even more powerful the more you even just lean in and just talk about it. And it's, again, it's just, it's talking about, again, material that not just anyone can talk about. And I think altogether, it is also good at, for lack of a better word, probably just showing that the more you don't even want to talk about something like that, the more it's going to explode in your face. You know, it's, you know, with seeing how heated real life and racially charged violence has become in lately, you know, it's like, yeah, it's going to keep happening the more you don't want to talk about it. And I mean, again, his material is also just for a very, you know, he wants you to come away with your own kind of conclusions on it, as well as just listen to it. You got to hear it. And when I'm done, you know, then you can talk. It is that kind of movie. It's like, and to act like everything, you know, anyone who thinks the world is black and white, no, this movie's, and figuratively, you know, those movies are not for you, because the world is just hard to explain and break down, and he's getting into material that, you know, much like Tarantino, he likes to tease the audience and even remind us, see, you know, I'm saying something that I know is going to piss off the average individual, and he'll, in that same scene, often have a character say, it's like, see, why are you getting angry?
Yeah, I can't have a
conversation with you.
I hope I didn't sort of misspeak when I was telling you know, the fact that he makes his message clear, but I think he also, you know, he delivers it the way he wants to, what he wants to say, but he also, it's up to you to unpack that. Like, he gives it to you straight, but he knows that he can't then, you know, he can lead a horse to water, but he can't make it drink. It's up to people to unpack that. And certain people with a certain mindset are never probably going to even watch the movies. I won't unpack it.
Oh, yeah.
Other people, I think it's a mistake that people make when they try and pretend there are aspects of society that are getting better and are becoming colorblind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not the way. And if they're watching these films and unpacking things, even if it makes them uncomfortable and they're having difficult thought processes, that's a good thing. That's part of what he helps to precipitate through, like, your mind, which is basically a service to film audiences.
Totally a service, yeah.
It's okay, every other weekend you can go and watch something like Moonfall. That's fine. And then occasionally watch a Spike Lee film and start thinking about points he's making. But as I say, he makes them clear enough, but he leaves it there for every viewer might unpack things slightly differently because there's enough there in each film that he does.
Right? Didn't happen overnight. No. Well, thank you ever so much for being on here. This has been very intriguing and to the point. So once again, I know we already did this, but what are you going to be reviewing next?
Next is... I watched a terrible film lately called Land Mangoes Click on Amazon Prime. That will be getting reviewed, and that will be a fun one for me to review because I'm quite angry. And then I saw the new
than Spike.
Yeah, I saw the new Firestarter movie, so that'll be soon. And then, you know, once a week we don't get as much content as you, but with it's Raiders of the Podcast as my podcast. So this week we're doing Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure for a bit of fun, and I picked The Innocents, the new I think it's a 2021 movie from the. From the guy who'd he wrote The Worst Person in the World and some other Joaquin Trier movies, if I've pronounced that properly.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be good. There's always plenty on my viewing plate.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.